What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care. So sit back, relax, and defocus.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Defocus Media podcast with Optometry Times. You know, we're entering the end of the year season, and I always like to talk about what's the biggest story that affected optometry this year as we kind of bring 2017 to a close. And I don't know if this is the obvious one for you guys, but I definitely think that the biggest thing that happened in optometry this year was the DEWS 2 report. Now, everyone might be listening to that and be like, that came out. It didn't really seem to affect my practice. I don't know that I learned very much from it. But I think we were overwhelmed by the size and the scope of the document, and it was just so overwhelming, it was hard to siphon down to the very distinct talking points that kind of has transformed how we should think and prescribe and diagnose and treat dry eye. So I wanted to kind of do this final look at 2017 podcast, going really deep into how the new DEWS 2 report is going to change the face of how we think about dry eye and optometry going forward for the next decade or more. In this podcast, we're going to talk to some of the leading minds in dry eye disease and major contributors to the DEWS 2 podcast. So sit back and relax and kind of open up your mind to rethinking everything you thought you knew about dry eye disease. I'd like to welcome to the show, we've got three very esteemed colleagues that were major contributors on the DEWS 2 report. Please welcome Dr. Jennifer Craig of the Auckland University in New Zealand, Dr. James Wolfson of Aston University in the UK, and Dr. Lyndon Jones of the University of Waterloo. Thank you guys so very much for joining us today. Tell us a little bit about yourselves and your background in ocular surface disease.
My name is Jennifer Craig. I'm an associate professor in ophthalmology at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, and I was the co-chair of the subcommittee on the definition and classification of dry eye.
And my name is James Wolfson. I'm an associate pro vice chancellor and a professor of optometry at Aston University, and I was responsible for the diagnostic methodology.
I'm Lyndon Jones. I'm a director of the Centre for Contact Lens Research at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, and I was the chair of the Management and Therapy Committee.
Excellent. So when did work begin on the DEWS 2 report? How many years does it take to craft a document like this?
It takes about 2.5 years. It took us from beginning to end to craft the document. It involved very many people, 150 people from 23 countries. So that takes a lot of time to get everybody together. And if you look at the volume of research that has been done since the original TFOS DEWS, the original dry eye workshop, it's been enormous, and so there's very, very many thousands of papers to review. And so, yes, it's a big process, 2.5 years.
So the DEWS 2 report is 380 pages in length, and I know for myself and a lot of optometrists, when we first sat down to look at this when I got published, I was very motivated. I started reading, and then a few pages in, I was like, "Ooh, this is just so much to kind of take in," and it's easy to get lost in just the amount of information. That doesn't mean the information is not very important and is not really changing the way I'm thinking about dry eye in my own practice, but I want to use this podcast as kind of a way to just siphon down the most clinically relevant points and the things that are really going to change the way we view and treat and think about dry eye. I think that's got to start with the new definition of dry eye. It talks about the loss of homeostasis of the tear film. What do you want doctors to take away from that idea of tear film homeostasis?
I think the loss of homeostasis is the new part of the definition, something that's different from the previous definition. What we were hoping was to try and encompass the myriad of changes that can occur within the tear film and the ocular surface in the condition of dry eye. So within this definition, we're trying to make it clear to doctors that to have dry eye, you need to have both symptoms and signs. And those signs can be many and varied that can occur. James will talk about the diagnostic criteria, and certain signs have been chosen. But we understand that in dry eye, very many different changes can occur.
So historically, we think of our typical dry eye patient as a middle-aged female, but as we're reading about this, you know, new definition of dry eye and the new way of defining and describing it, I think a new patient profile is emerging. Yes, middle-aged women definitely do still have dry eye, and you talk about in the DEWS 2 report about things like gender and age affecting the chance and the likelihood of the diagnosis, but what do you see as the new patient demographic or group that we should really be thinking dry eye?
So I don't necessarily think that the definition is necessarily pointing to a different patient profile. What we are seeing, I think, in clinical practice is certainly younger patients who are presenting with dry eye. I think the use of digital devices by younger patients is certainly producing many, many young patients, 20 to 30-year-olds, who are typically suffering from symptoms of dry eye because of the volume of work that they're doing on digital devices.
I definitely know in my own patients, I'm seeing dry eye in teenagers and 20-year-olds and really young children, unfortunately. And there's so much device use and medication use and things like that that we think about in younger patients that makes them a really high risk candidate for developing pretty significant dry eye symptoms at a very, very young age. So it was exciting to me to read this port and see, yes, that patient profile, you need to look for dry eye much, much younger, because I know I'm seeing it in patient care. Let's talk a little bit about the diagnostic tests. How should we look for dry eye according to the DOES-2 report and your findings?
Sure. One of the things we wanted to do with the Diagnostic Methodology Committee was to look at all of the myriad of tests that were out there. And of course, lots of clinicians have their preference for certain tests, and they vary by country as well, and try and narrow that down to some core tests that need to be performed for the diagnosis. And if we go back to the definition, it's very clear that symptoms need to be involved in that diagnosis. So while some people talk about a dry eye without symptoms, actually dry eye is a subgroup of ocular surface disease, and that subgroup has symptoms. So the first thing we need is a screening test, and looking at the many questionnaires that are out there, the two that were selected that are best validated was the Ocular Surface Disease Index, the LSDI, and the Dry Eye Questionnaire, the DEQ, with the five items. So there's a screening element to pick people up first of all. And then if they are determined to have the cutoff levels of one of those two questionnaires, we would work into our tests for signs. And those are a non-invasive breakup time, ideally done objectively. We have said that fluorescein can be used if you don't have any other test. But again, we don't want things that are going to disrupt the tear film. And quite often, the performance of a fluorescein-based breakup time can be quite variable. And then the second test that we recommend is osmolarity. Again, the way we perform this is by taking a test of the two eyes and looking at both the level of the highest eye and the interoperative difference. And then finally, ocular surface staining. So we're not just looking at the cornea or even the conjunctiva, but also the lid margin as well. And with both of the key dyes, fluorescein, which is a key corneal dye, and mycinine green, which also brings out features of the conjunctiva and lid margin. So it's a combination of those conditions with key focus on, as we said, symptomology, and then one of the three other signs forming the diagnosis. And then going forward from there, we move into our subclassification tests, so looking at things like the meibomian glands and also indicators of the volume with our tear meniscus.
I think that's really exciting. We've got so many different ways to check and measure dry eye now: inflammatory tests, MMP9, imaging and screenings, and all of those are really great. But they can be expensive. And when a doctor thinks about, man, I really want to find dry eye, is this going to be a burden for me to invest in the equipment I need to detect it? And, you know, research is showing you can do a very good job of finding and diagnosing dry eye with normed questionnaire, like a speed questionnaire, and just traditional staining, not cost invasive to any practitioner that wants to really make dry eye a focus. One of the biggest take homes for me from the DOES-2 report was the discussion about pain and how pain and dry eye symptoms and severity really don't necessarily go hand in hand together. I think that's something we've all been so frustrated by in our clinical care. We have a patient that's miserable in front of us. They might look really good. They might have no staining. Their T-butt might be 9 or 10 seconds. And we're thinking, man, we've really helped this patient, but they still feel terrible. And the way that you guys addressed this topic was very enlightening. There was a whole discussion of two different types of dry eye pain or sensitivity on the corneal surface. We've got that differentiation between nociceptive pain and neuropathic pain. So let's break that down a little bit and help doctors figure out what are we talking about when we talk about these two different pain pathways?
Yeah, that's a good point. So certainly the difference between nociceptive pain and neuropathic pain is a really important aspect that's been certainly categorized very, very nicely in this HEAMS 2 report. So as we know, nociceptive pain is basically pain that arises from sort of actual damage to the tissue. And this is the typical type of pain that we do see in patients with symptoms and signs of dry eye. When you compare that with neuropathic pain, neuropathic pain is pain basically caused by a lesion or disease of the peripheral and central somatosensory system, and really is sort of the pain that you get really without any sort of biological value at all. And so typically what we see with neuropathic pain is patients in whom there is a significant amount of pain without really any signs at all. And those are typically the ones that have been very, very difficult to deal with historically. And really, any treatment that we typically use for dry eyes, it really doesn't work in these patients. And those are the patients that we need to sort out, because they really need to be referred for pain management. And really, that's outside of the sort of typical scope of what you would do as a dry eye practitioner.
Do you see a future where optometrists are closely partnered with pain management doctors to try to help treat these patients, where it becomes a referral source between ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it at all. And I think, again, it's important that the practitioners do actually read that the difference between these two. That's a big thing within these two, because those patients really are not best managed within clinical practice. They really do need to be referred out for pain management. But I think that's a very good point that you made.
So there's a great section later on in the DEUCE 2 report about the importance of the eyelid and friction from blinking and dry eye. And I want to know, how would you rate the importance of evaluating things like blink rate and lid wiper epitheliopathy when you're talking about really diagnosing and managing dry eye disease?
We've already said in the new diagnosis that ocular surface staining, including that lid area lid margin, is a really important aspect of the diagnosis. So that certainly should be an element. In terms of the blink rate, obviously many factors affect your blink rate. There's really the change in blink rate in an individual that can be quite important. And we know that that certainly happens when you're using VVU cream, for example. But interestingly, it's not just the blink rate, but also the completeness of the blink that seems to be related to particularly symptomology. So I think that observation of our patient, as we should be doing with any patient, is an important aspect of the overall management of dry eye.
You just have to make sure that you don't tell them that you're looking at the blink rate, or they'll change their blink.
Very true.
Right, it's so easy to disrupt a good blink rate quality score because when you are actively looking at it, it makes people act differently. So it's really hard to measure blink rate. But the best advice I have for doctors trying to do it is just look at the slit lamp, or look when you're talking to patients during the kind of pre-exam period where you're like just getting to know the patient, saying hello. Just look really intently at their blink before any evaluation begins. And that's probably the best giveaway. If you can get really good at kind of seeing how often do they blink, do they really look like they're closing their eyes when they blink? And once you start paying attention to it, you'll see a lot of surprising truths show themselves. So the DEUCE 2 report, it's a massive document. We've got doctors from around the world that have contributed to this. So I want to know, was there any point of contention about what should be included, what shouldn't be included? Anything that didn't make the cut within the DEUCE 2 report? What was this process like?
Well, I mean, I think people would argue and say in 400 pages we must have included every single thing we could possibly think of. But no, some things didn't make the cut, certainly. It's based on evidence, so we were very strong on making sure that it was high quality evidence from the scientific literature. We looked for the best quality trials. We looked, you know, everything needed to be the best evidence that we could get. So if we had, for example, abstracts or anecdotal evidence, we needed to be very careful about what was included. Anecdotal evidence didn't make it. It needed to be published in the scientific literature to be included. So things like that didn't make the cut. But otherwise, we covered all the good quality research.
So the work is not done. And I think that's another point where we're talking about, man, this is such important work and the work is not finished. This report is not the end all be all, because we still have not created a treatment algorithm for if you see this, start this treatment. You know, and that's really going to be essential to a doctor establishing their clinical care pattern. Right now, you guys are working with the Tear Film Ocular Surface Society to design this treatment algorithm for best practices in dry eye. And there's a survey going around. Many doctors might have received it in their email already. And I want to see, you know, tell us about how we can get involved if we want to help contribute to this treatment algorithm.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The work continues in this area. And particularly with management, one of the things that we identified through the report, that while we have good evidence that most of the treatments work compared to, for example, a control, where we don't know, what we don't know is how they all fit together. So how severe does a disease need to be before a particular treatment should be introduced? Is it more for the aqueous type or the evaporative type of dry eye? So this is a really important aspect clinically. So what we're currently doing is sending out a survey to practitioners to look out for how they currently practice. And with that information, we'll be able to inform them of how it differs between countries and how they fit in to what their peers are doing, but likewise to identify areas of new research where we can help to develop this algorithm for the future. In terms of getting involved, the link will be sent out through TFOS, so practitioners can look out for that link. And we are also contacting ambassadors in each country to help make sure that we get a wide coverage so we get really good information back. And we'd really encourage practitioners to be a part of that, no matter how they feel they currently practice, because that will help them and inform them on their practice for the future, and likewise allow us to optimally treat our patients.
Still in the process of developing treatment algorithm based on the DEUCE 2 report, but just over the data collected and all the work you guys have done in writing this DEUCE 2 report, what do you think are some of the major take-home messages that doctors should start thinking about right now about how they think and talk and treat dry eye needs to be different than what they were treating and talking about when it came to dry eye based on the original DEUCE report? I mean, what changes immediately should a doctor start making in their office and practice concerning dry eye based on the DEUCE 2 report right now?
I think one of the major things that we're very aware of, and certainly you read the most recent DEFOS DEUCE 2 management therapy report, we'll see the incredible scope of management options that are covered. You'll see that there are over 1,000 pieces of reference documentation in the new management and therapy report. And that really reflects very nicely how in the past decade, the explosion of opportunities that have now kind of occurred from patients to manage their patients. 10 years ago, pretty much the only management options that we had available to us were largely around drops. Whereas now, what we see is not only are drops available, but the variety of drops that are available are incredible, particularly the differentiation between sort of lipid-based drops compared with aqueous-based drops. That's been a big change. And we've seen a massive explosion in our understanding of things like diet and how diet can really impact dry eye. There's a very nice section in the newest report relating to the use of omega-6 and omega-3 supplements. Also, the things like the options available with regards to surgical options, the drugs that are available. There's a very large section on the prescription drugs that are now available. Simply 10 years ago, those options didn't exist. So I think certainly practitioners would be very well advised to read the latest management therapy options.
So, I mean, we're in a very exciting time right now. I think for years, we've been frustrated by dry eye because we can see it, we can tell it's out there, we have treatments for it, but these treatments don't work for everybody, and we don't really understand why. And we're getting closer and closer, I think, to unlocking some of the mysteries of dry eye disease and finding much better ways to treat our patients' symptoms and signs. And if that's not exciting, I don't know what is. So finding our patients' relief, that's what we all got into this profession to do. And it's just exciting to be on the cutting edge and seeing us move forward in a way that might really be able to help patients. Thank you all so very much for joining us today. I know we're talking to you from across many, many different time zones and countries, and I appreciate the time that you took out of your schedule to join us and kind of give us that real take-home message in case anyone was thinking, man, yeah, the DEUCE 2 report that came out, but my life moved on and I haven't thought twice about it. Hopefully that based on this podcast today, you're kind of rethinking what you thought that report was telling you and what you thought it didn't tell you and how little it was going to impact you. Because there is a lot there that could really change how you're talking about dry eye in your practice starting tomorrow.
Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with Defocus Media. We hope something resonated with you today. Please subscribe to our podcast and remember, we keep it 2020 around here, pun intended. We look forward to seeing you next time.